Hello there. Today is Thursday, January 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a harsh sentence for the doctor convicted of molesting at least 160 young Olympians.
The defendant is a twisted, beloved, renowned doctor who used his prestige to gain trust of these girls.
A former U.S. diplomat resigns from a committee working to assist with the crisis in Myanmar. North Korea's surprising statement heard on state-run media. Also ahead, big news from a very big world-renowned superstar. It's all on today's International Edition. Former USA Gymnastics team physician Larry Nassar has been sentenced up to 175 years in prison after pleading guilty to sexually abusing female gymnasts, some as young as 10 years old. About 160 of Nassar's victims gave emotional statements at his sentencing hearing in a circuit court in Lansing, Michigan. Prosecutor Angelita Pavlidis said this just before the sentence.
The defendant is a twisted, beloved, renowned doctor who used his prestige to gain trust of these girls, to exploit them, leaving many of them emotionally shattered, used by a man that they not only trusted, but also loved.
Judge Rosemarie Aquilina said she's handing him his death warrant, but that justice required more than she could do.
My page only goes to 100 years. Sir, I'm giving you 175 years.
Nassar pleaded guilty in November to 10 counts of first-degree sexual assault. U.S. Olympic gold medalist Simone Biles, Gabby Douglas, and Michaela Maroney were among the athletes who have said in recent months they were assaulted by Nassar during medical treatment. Joining us now to discuss this stunning story is San Diego-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro. How unprecedented was that? Was it that 160 women were allowed to actually give victim statements? I guess the whole thing really is unprecedented in itself.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. First off, the whole situation was unprecedented in the number of victims that came forward, the number of charges that were brought, and particularly the number of young ladies that actually spoke at the sentencing hearing. That coupled with the fact that, for a sentencing hearing, it's high. You know, usually representing individuals who have been accused of multiple acts against multiple victims, not always does every victim come forward. You know, not always does every victim come forward to begin with, let alone come forward at court, come forward at sentencing, and speak in such a, highly publicized sentencing. So I was a little bit surprised by that. You know, what do we attribute that to? Do we attribute that to, strength in numbers? Do we attribute it to the overall egregious conduct that these women, although were unable to stand up to themselves or stand up for themselves previously, now have found the strength in numbers, and good for them if that's the case? You know, or is it a product of the environment we live in today where, people are speaking up day in, day out about sexual abuse and about workplace abuse and women and men for that example, being taken advantage of by people of authority.
Right. And I think the fact that these were young girls, teenagers, and this was a doctor their parents entrusted their care to, the whole story has just been so appalling on so many levels.
Definitely is something as a parent you think about, because in this environment, you send your child to pursue their dreams, and you trust the people that you're sending them to, especially when under 18 years old, to look out for their best interest, their physical and mental well-being. The last thing you would expect or the greatest fear would be that, they'd be taken advantage of in hopes of pursuing their dreams.
Dr. Nassar had written a letter sort of scolding the judge, saying, she was looking for media attention and that it was too much for him. It was too difficult for him to hear all of these girls come forward and testify. And boy, the judge really gave it to him. And I think from there, it sort of went downhill where the judge was really not letting up on him.
Yeah, I mean, there were, when you say statements, my next question was going to be which one, because I've heard so many that in my opinion, are borderline inappropriate. But it gets hard to look at this and say, anyone should have any sympathy for him or what's inappropriate. I mean, what he did, what he was convicted of doing is as inappropriate as anything, let alone just being scolded by a judge. But, you know, her comments, in my opinion, were questionable. He did not help his cause to prevent certain comments and to prevent harsh sentence with his written statement blasting the judge. I mean, as his attorney, that's not something I would have advised him to do. However, I'm aware of the fact that, you know, he could definitely mail a letter to the court without me knowing it's his attorney. But that usually doesn't get you anywhere. But, you know, sometimes I wonder when representing people who are in a case like this where they wind up doing a significant amount of time, from his perspective, what did he really have to lose? He knew he was going to get a boatload of decades in prison, probably the rest of his natural life and beyond in terms of a sentence. So, you know, if he ever wanted to have his voice heard, whether he's justified in that or not, mm-hmm. you know, he has a right to be heard and certainly didn't help his cause. I don't know if it makes him feel any better. You just hope that there's some, I don't want to say closure. That's a word that's used too frequently, but some a little more peace of mind to the victims of the crime. And hopefully they could get back their lives to as normal as possible, given everything that's gone on.
Boy, but her comments about I'm signing your death warrant. I mean, wow, I've never heard a judge say something like that.
I mean, she could have said that because she was just moved by hearing, you know, 100 and some odd victim impact statements. She could move by appalled by the letter that he wrote or his comments. And, you know, part of it could have been hamming it up for the camera. You know, I think that her name now is out there more, not so much because of this case and because of the sentence, but because of comments like that, whether right or wrong. And you don't know whether, you know, the media or the exposure gets the better of people, or whether she has some ulterior motive in making a name for herself and what her aspirations are. You know, we see this a lot, whether it's a Casey Anthony trial, whether it's, you know, O.J. Simpson back in the 90s, whether it's whatever, all these key players, you know, there's speculation about what the judges want to do in the future, whether it's TV, whether it's to write a book, whether it's legal analyst type work, you know, and you always have to take their comments with a grain of salt. But I still think it was inappropriate, particularly about the death warrant and all that stuff. You know, less is more sometimes when you're sentencing someone to hundreds of years in prison.
All right. Thank you so much. San Diego-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro. We appreciate it. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The UN says 1.5 million South Sudanese are on the brink of famine. Protests roil the Swiss cities ahead of Trump's Davos visit. Citizenship for Dreamers, Trump says it is going to happen. And a film about the Kenya terror attack is up for an Oscar. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Former U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson resigned Wednesday from an international board that advises Myanmar, also known as Burma, on the Rohingya crisis, charging the panel was not committed to change in the Southeast Asian country. Richardson said Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi was deficient in moral leadership, an accusation that came 2 days after a meeting with her and other board members.
She believes there's a concerted international effort against Myanmar, and I believe she is wrong. She blames all the problems that Myanmar is having on the international media, on the UN, on human rights groups, on other governments. And I think this is caused by the bubble that is around her, by individuals that are not giving her frank advice. I was very unhappy and distressed by Dow and San Suu Kyi's reaction to my plea that this issue of the Reuters journalists be treated fairly and rapidly. And that brought almost an explosion on her part, saying there were issues relating to the Official Secrecies Act, that this was not my charter as a member of the advisory board. And it was a very heated exchange that we had. I also disagree with the direction the chairman, Surakiat, wants to take the advisory board. There's no agenda. There's no plan to address some of the issues relating to safety, to citizenship. I don't want to be part of a whitewash. And I felt it's best that I resign immediately.
VOA's Richardson, by the way, a former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and energy secretary in the Bill Clinton administration, quit amidst the board's first visit to the Western Rakhine State, where nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled a military crackdown on insurgents in the last 5 months. VOA's Victor Beatty asks, Professor Monique Skidmore, Deputy Vice Chancellor at the University of Tasmania in Australia, if she's surprised by Richardson's decision.
Given his significant disagreement with Aung San Suu Kyi over the fate of two journalists from Reuters that have been recently arrested and charged under the Official Secrets Act in Myanmar, I'm not surprised that he felt compelled to take that action. I am surprised that Aung San Suu Kyi is seeking to so narrowly implement or interpret the recommendation of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's report on the causes and changes required to bring back transparency and security in Rakhine State.
Are you saying she's not fully embracing those recommendations?
The committee itself hasn't made any recommendations as to how to implement the former report, but clearly Aung San Suu Kyi is trying to deal with it in a logistical way, in a way that has to do with aid, rather than moving into any of the areas that include national security. And that's going, and really that means that that Governor Bill Richardson may be right. This may end up being a whitewash if it continues to not tackle the underlying causes, as Kofi Annan very clearly spelled out, that are leading the Rohingya to leave in such numbers.
Richardson said Aung San Suu Kyi lacks moral leadership. Is that a surprising statement?
No, it's not a surprising statement. I suppose it's surprising to all of us who've followed Myanmar for so many years that Aung San Suu Kyi has taken such a weak role in this, that this is not an issue that she has ever spoken strongly about. Even when she accepted her Nobel Peace Prize, she simply spoke about the Rohingya as communal unrest. She's never shown leadership on this issue. And whilst we all understand the complexities of the emerging transition to democracy, the rise of Buddhist fundamentalism, the importance and the critical role that the military still has under the Constitution, there still truly has been a complicity by Aung San Suu Kyi, which of course is disappointing for everyone who's ever known her.
Does his resignation from this board do to its final report?
It won't do anything at the moment other than further diminish its credibility. We need to see if any other members resign, and we need to see if any recommendations are implemented from Kofi Annan's report. Otherwise, it will be a whitewash. Hopefully, what's happened with Governor Bill Richardson resigning is that he is shining the spotlight back on Aung San Suu Kyi, increasing the pressure, and further increased pressure internationally can only be a good thing for the people of the Rakhine State.
Mr. Richardson said that Aung San Suu Kyi is not getting good advice from her team. Is she getting poor advice?
It's impossible to know that. I think Governor Richardson has been a long-time colleague of Aung San Suu Kyi. He's known her since the 1980s. He is disappointed. I think he's in some ways giving her an out by suggesting that it's the advice that she's getting. But of course, she is a very strong-minded and intelligent woman. And I, as an anthropologist, having watched her over so many years, have always seen such strong Buddhist and orthodox Buddhist opinions. And I've never heard her voice anything that we could see as strong support for Muslims in the country.
Well, Monique, we have not spoken yet about the Rohingya crisis. There's this repatriation plan that's supposed to be implemented. It has been delayed. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, Victor, as you know, there's been repatriation deals between Bangladesh and Myanmar in the past, and we still have people in camps in Myanmar, confined to camps from the last time they were repatriated from Bangladesh. So there's no evidence that there will be villages rebuilt. We're being told that Rohingya will be given some materials and told to rebuild them themselves, but as yet there's no evidence that there's even enough transition camps set up, or that they would ever be allowed out of the camps. And certainly there's been no changes to the underlying regulations, no changes to citizenship, freedom of movement, freedom of employment and marriage laws that would be required, and certainly no transparency regarding the actions of security forces in Rakhine State. So it's no wonder, of course, that the Rohingya are simply largely refusing to go back voluntarily.
Has this matter tarnished Aung San Suu Kyi's global image?
It has done irreparable damage. No, even if Aung San Suu Kyi today entirely implemented every recommendation of Kofi Annan's report, and even if we saw peace and security in Rakhine State, we still have to think about the complicity of the hundreds of lives lost, of the systematic violence, the rape of women and children, the suffering occurring in refugee camps and in the perilous lives of people who fled through the systematic ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya people from Rakhine State from August last year.
That's Professor Monique Skidmore, Deputy Vice Chancellor at the University of Tasmania in Australia. North Korea's state media sent a rare announcement addressed to, quote, all Koreans at home and abroad on Thursday, saying they should make a breakthrough for unification without the help of other countries. It said all Koreans should promote contact travel cooperation between North and South Korea. The announcement, issued after a joint meeting of government and political parties, added Koreans should wage an energetic drive to defuse the acute military tension and create a peaceful climate on the Korean Peninsula. It's a complete shift in position and tone from the North. Joining us now to discuss is Troy Stangerone, Senior Director with the Korea Economic Institute of America. What do you think North Korea is really doing with this long statement?
This looks to be along the lines of what many have discussed of a North Korean effort to try and create a wedge between South Korea and the United States. It talks about working on their own without the influence of outside powers on reunification. It pushes for more interaction between the two countries. So this isn't surprising given where North Korea is right now.
Do you think this is a temporary attitude, or do you think that they're actually serious about any of this, besides the fact that they're trying to drive a wedge between the United States and the South?
I think this is a temporary tactic on their part. While there had been concerns that North Korea might try to disrupt the Olympics, it was something that was probably unlikely for the long period. Given the tensions on the peninsula right now, if the North had conducted a test, be it either an ICBM test or a nuclear weapon, or even what some had feared actually had perhaps, attacked South Korea during the Games, there would have been significant international backlash against the regime. And I think they realized that. And so for this period, they needed to change the narrative and move away from the tensions that had been taking place between the United States, South Korea, and others on the peninsula. And so right now, as they've shifted to this more engagement posture, I think they realize that this is temporary, because once the Olympics end, U.S. exercises will begin. They have not completed all their tests. At some point, be it either immediately or shortly thereafter, they will need to take and conduct another test. So I think this is them trying to exploit a sort of narrow window for driving their agenda, as opposed to moving back into the real challenge that we face in terms of denuclearization.
Does this put South Korea in a compromising position? Because obviously they're a very strong ally with the United States.
I think this puts South Korea in a potentially unique position in that North Korea isn't really offering anything here, but they are showing a willingness to perhaps explore different combinations. So if you look at the statement, they say no one should slander what they refer to as the treasured sword, which is the nuclear program, which I think demonstrates a good deal of sensitivity on their part to how the nuclear weapons program is perceived internationally and even in the South. And so I think what that means is that now that North Korea has kind of showed what they might like to do, they've talked about promoting travel and cooperation and exchange, and all of these are clearly an attempt to try and get South Korea to move away from the sanctions regime that's in place. But the one that to me is the most interesting is the travel component. If we go back to Kim Jong-un's New Year's Day statement, he said North and South Koreans should be able to travel to each other's countries. And this, I think, is interesting because I don't think this is something that North Korea actually wants at all. I think they would be very afraid of any type of real movement between North and South. And so I think it creates an opportunity, because the things North Korea really wants, South Korea isn't in a position to take and reverse international sanctions or end the exercises, and it wouldn't be in South Korea's own interest. But pushing North Korea to see if they are actually willing to open up travel, which might then change the long-term dynamics on the peninsula, could be an interesting opportunity.
Do you think that the stronger sanctions and the tough tone that the Trump administration has taken created these actions?
I think sanctions have played a significant role here. If we look at recent trade data, if you go back to October, November, you were seeing some decline in trade on the North Korean side, but not necessarily a significant amount. The December numbers that are somewhat provisional right now between North Korea and China are very significant. You're seeing large drop-offs in trade between the two. So I think North Korea finds itself in a much more precarious financial situation than it may have seemed perhaps 3 or 4 months ago, and that the trend lines are not good. And so their perspective, they need to do anything they can to reverse this so that way they can take and avoid the pressure that sanctions are pushing on them to take and come to the table. There's nothing in North Korea's offer that would take and I think be an incentive to move away from the current policy of economic sanctions. If you look at their broader theme of working together, it's unclear how this would be a real cooperation between North and South Korea in the terms of, you know, how you take and move together as one people when it seems to be wanting to move together under basically North Korean auspices rather than South Korean or jointly. And I think one other challenge that just is important to keep in mind is that there has been significant change in recent years in how South Koreans perceive North Korea. Unification is not necessarily something that South Koreans are actively looking for. Progressives would like to see a period of peaceful coexistence before unification. And in terms of how South Koreans view themselves, they are shifting much more to a civic identity as opposed to an identity based on ethnicity. And so in many ways, I think a North Korean push for reunification at this time is really sort of out of sync with where the trends are in South Korea, and in some ways shows both how out of touch North Korea is with the international community and its nuclear program, but also with how merely to actually perhaps engage with South Korea.
So basically, it doesn't sound like anything really has changed or will change, given that they're not planning on giving up their nuclear program, and the sanctions are definitely not going to go away if they don't.
This essentially, on the surface, looks to be an offer of, let's work together, but we're not going to move an inch on the thing that we know that matters to you, which is the nuclear program.
All right, that's Troy Stangerone, Senior Director with the Korea Institute, or Korea Economic Institute of America. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Famed rapper Eminem has just released a new single in which he joins forces with singer Ed Sheeran. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks to VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London, who has all the details.
We're going to be hearing a song which is the second single off Eminem's 9th album. And the album is called Revival. He said back in 2016 that he was writing music for a new album, and here we are. The new album came out. It topped the UK charts when it was released at the end of 2017. It's doing okay, but it's met with kind of questionable reviews from the critics. But nonetheless, he's got an interesting collection of artists that he has recorded with for this new album. The first single that he put out was a song that he sang with Beyoncé. Eminem and Beyoncé, who would have ever thought? The song is called Walk on Water. And for today, we've got Ed Sheeran and Eminem, and this is called River. So let the river
run. He's coming home with his neck scratched to catch flack. Sweat jackets and dress slacks mismatched on his breast jack. He's a sex addict and she just...
Well, yeah, Eminem, he's sort of been in the news and out of the news as much. You don't quite hear about him as much as you used to.
Well, he can afford to take some time off and step away, and that's what he's done, although sometimes that can backfire on an artist. But he's now decided to come back. It's been a couple of years since his last album was out. He is going to be headlining the Coachella Valley Music Festival in Palm Springs, California in April, along with Beyoncé and The Weeknd. And of course, as I mentioned, Beyoncé and Eminem recorded the first single on Eminem's new album, which is Revival. The song was called Walk on Water. Today, he chose to sing with Ed Sheeran. Ed is still on tour for his latest album, Divide. And big news for Ed Sheeran fans, the Sheerios. He announced just recently he got engaged to his longtime girlfriend, Cherry Seaborn. It was only natural because they've been sweethearts since school days. And so congratulations to Ed on that bit of good news. He'll be performing at the Grammys this weekend. He's nominated for two. Eminem, he credits Eminem for helping him overcome stuttering as a child.
Huh. Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, Ed Sheeran wow. said that he stuttered, and it was Eminem's rap music that helped him to work through that. And he said to record with him was one of the highlights of his career so far, which is kind of an honor for someone like Ed Sheeran to credit Eminem with that kind of an honor. Also, on the new album, by the way, as I was mentioning, some unique artists. Pink is on the new album. Skylar Grey is on the new album. He's got quite a collection of folks that you wouldn't normally associate with Eminem music, but Eminem did say that he wanted to mix it up a little bit. His next album, he's already talking about the next album, will be working with his original producer who discovered him back in about 2002, Dr. Dre. So Eminem's going back to his roots with Dr. Dre. So this is all interesting times. Eminem back on tour, doing some big major festivals this summer. And, of course, the ninth album is now out. It's called Revival.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
And I know she's using me to try to play him. I don't care. Hi, Suzanne. But I should have said bye, Suzanne, after the first night. But tonight I am.
I've been a liar, been a thief, been a lover, been a cheat. Oh, my sin.
Elton John is saying goodbye to the road after his upcoming three-year global tour, capping over 50 years on stages around the world. He's calling it a way to go out with a bang. The 70-year-old singer, pianist, and composer said he wants to spend time with his family. His children will be 8 and 10 when he stops in 2021, and he said he hoped he might be able to take them to a soccer practice. He made the announcements at an event in New York. Final tour, dubbed Farewell Yellow Brick Road, starts in September and consists of 300 shows around the world. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today. Thanks for being with us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains vigilant to prevent Iran from gaining any new ground in the Middle East. Speaking to the Israeli Knesset, Vice President Mike Pence said, "The United States will continue to work with Israel and with nations across the world to confront the leading state sponsor of terror, the Islamic Republic of Iran." The regime in Iran is a brutal dictatorship that seeks to dominate its citizens and deny them their most fundamental rights. History has proven those who dominate their own people rarely stop there, said Mr. Pence. And increasingly, we see Iran seeking to dominate the wider Arab world. The Iranian regime sows chaos across the region. Last year alone, even as its citizens cried out for help with basic necessities, Iran devoted more than $4 billion to malign activities in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere across the region. It has supported terrorist groups that even now sit on Israel's doorstep. The U.S. is working to enact effective and lasting restraints on Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, said Mr. Pence. Earlier this month, the president waived sanctions on Iran to give the Congress and our European allies time to pass stronger measures. But as President Trump made clear, this is the last time. The United States vowed, Vice President Pence, will never allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. Beyond the nuclear deal, we will also no longer tolerate Iran's support of terrorism or its brutal attempts to suppress its own people. To the people of Iran, the U.S. has another message, declared Mr. Pence. We are your friends, and the day is coming when you will be free from the evil regime that suffocates your dreams and buries your hopes. And when your day of liberation finally comes, we say to the good people of Iran, the friendship between our peoples will blossom once again.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.